Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. I apologize for starting late. I have made some errors in the construction of the agenda today, and I apologize for that. I've had a conversation with all affected parties. I did not mean any offense at anybody, and I do apologize. We had one understanding that we had 15 bills to get done, and whether they were able to be done in one day or 2 days was somewhat of a question. But I should have been more careful in making sure that everybody was consulted about the agenda before we started, and I failed to do that, and for that I apologize. With that, I'd like to start a work session on Senate Bill 385 and ask Judith if she would read some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 385 is the measure that deals with the crime of eco-sabotage. You have at your seat at the dais now the Dash 3 amendments, as well as the Hann and Gross version of those. Dash 3 amendments define eco-sabotage as a felony offense which unlawfully interferes with either, one, the agricultural production, two, surface or underground mining, three, the protection, restoration, or management of wildlife, habitats, waterways, coastlines, farmlands, or forests, and finally, for the work of persons engaged in research, education, or advocacy of the aforementioned activities. The Dash 3 amendments also restore current law by deleting the removal of the statute of limitations regarding eco-sabotage crimes. It does allow the prosecution of an offense that constitutes eco-sabotage to commence within 5 years after the statute of limitation otherwise would be applicable. So, in other words, instead of having no statute of limitations, the Dash 3 amendments will extend, for whatever the base crime is, extend the statute of limitations for 5 years. It further establishes penalties to include up to a threefold the actual damages sustained and punitive damages when appropriate for an offense that constitutes eco-sabotage. It applies the 5-year extension of the statute of limitations to offenses committed before, on, or after the effective date, but do not revive a criminal prosecution that is resolved according to ORS 131.125 before the effective date. And finally, it applies the definition and penalties to action commenced on or after the effective date, regardless of when the predicate acts were committed. We have a no revenue impact statement, and we just received, and you have at your seat, the Dash 3 amendments, the fiscal impact on those. You will notice there the Department of Justice indicates that the associated costs would be absorbed within the existing budget. The Oregon Judicial Department, relating to costs of court filings, is expected to be minimal, and the Department of Corrections also recognizes that while the fiscal impact is indeterminate, it is not expected to have a large number of new convictions, and therefore, again, the fiscal impact is likely to be minimal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I'm going to ask Senator Farioli if he'd like to come up and make any comments about the work that's occurred on the bill, particularly maybe the latest version of an amendment that he and I worked out.
Mr. Chairman, Ted Farioli, State Senator, District 30. Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for having a hearing on the bill, and I would just urge my colleagues on the committee that I believe the bill has been improved. The bill essentially before you, I think, does some good things. First of all, as a result of our discussions, my discussions with the chair, we added some aspects that had earlier sort of escaped my attention, and that was part of what's under targeting by folks that do acts of violence and destruction is research facilities. Habitat restoration was added. I think that's an excellent idea. The other thing, of course, was instead of just lifting the statute of limitations, five-year extension seems reasonable, and I have the support of the district attorneys who thought that was a good tool for the toolbox. Those conclude my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I do want to note for the record that I've never seen such a ringing endorsement as the DA's endorsement. Although this is a bill that would be sparingly used by prosecutors, this is my DA, with such acts do occur, Senate Bill 385 with amendments would be of use. That is a ringing endorsement. Let's move it.
I was going to say just very quickly that I was happy with the work that we did on a bill, and I've had some interaction with folks at the experimental station that would be out in the middle of your district, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to put that in. They do good work out there. There is a real sense in which that kind of sabotage could occur at an experimental station. And I don't know why. All they do is work on range grass, you know, but who knows.
We're in work session.
Yeah. We're in work session, and before...
Yes. Was it after three amendments?
I was going to say before Senator Corcoran yawns anymore, let's move the dash three amendments. Is there any discussion of the dash threes? If there's no objection, the dash threes can be added then?
Chair, I move Senate Bill 385 to the floor as amended to the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 385 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Senate Bill 385 is the floor. I have a feeling that Senator Ferrioli would like to carry the bill.
At your pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
Great. It's yours. Have fun. Thank you.
This echo sabotage thing came out of Senator Ferrioli's experience at Grant High School in Portland, by the way. This is not a rural bill. Yeah, he's most popular gymnast.
Okay. Next on the agenda, Senate Bill 597 with some dash one amendments. Judith, can you speak? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 597 requires a person to hold a shellfish license when taking shellfish. It defines shellfish and establishes a marine shellfish subaccount in the Fish and Wildlife account. It directs the monies in the subaccount to be used for shellfish inspections, state police, wildlife law enforcement, and a shellfish biologist in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have the Dash 1 amendments, which you have, as well as the Hand and Gross version, and just this morning we have received the Dash 2 amendments, so I will also describe those. First of all, the Dash 1 amendments reduce to 50% from 54% the amount in the marine shellfish subaccount dedicated to the State Department of Agriculture Shellfish Inspection Program. It deletes references to commercial with respect to the shellfish inspection program for which the subaccount monies may be used. It increases from 28% the amount of the subaccount dedicated to state police for enforcement of wildlife laws pertaining to the taking of shellfish. And finally, the final revision in the numbers is that it increases to 21% from 18% the amount of the subaccount dedicated to fund a shellfish biologist and related expenses. It directs the Fish and Wildlife Commission to grant a free license for the taking of shellfish for the temporary use of any child placed by the Department of Human Services under care of a foster home or a certified private nonprofit child caring agency, and directs the commission to grant 30 free licenses for the taking of shellfish to each hospital or domiciliary for the temporary use of any person who is a patient or resident thereof after application by the Director of Veterans Administration Hospital or Domiciliary. We have a no revenue impact. We have a potential fiscal impact because this is going to Ways and Means. On the Dash 2 amendments, which you have at your seat, the Dash 2 amendments expand the criteria for a limited entry permit for the Dungeness crab fishery. If you look on page 2 of the amendment, the only change to current law, you'll see beginning on line 20, that the vessel for which application is made has landed at least 100,000 pounds of ground fish in each of two calendar years between January 1, 1998 and December 31, 2002. It is at least 65 feet in length and does not have a transferable ocean Dungeness crab permit and does not land more than 20,000 pounds per year of all types of whiting combined.
That would, that's
right.
We just received those this morning, so we don't have a separate fiscal or revenue on that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Over $73.
And that's an explanation. I'm a little confused on these amendments because we just got them, but I was told that potentially there was somebody here. Is Bob Jacobson here? Yeah. Do you want to speak to these amendments or to the dash two? Is that what I understood?
Senator Shields, this is the first time I have seen those amendments.
Okay.
So I'm really...
Okay. Okay.
They were written by Terry Thompson. We thought you'd appreciate them. So.
Okay. All I know about them is that I was handed them on the way down to committee, and I was told that they were fined by Joan Dukes, whose bill this is. And my only intention with this whole bill is just to send it without recommendation to Ways and Means so everything's all in one place, because they're the ones dealing with it.
Works this.
Mr. Chair, I think we should leave the dash twos out of the bill and let them deal with them in Ways and Means if they so choose, because we don't know anything about them.
That's fine.
Makes sense.
That's fine by me. You want to do dash one?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, dash one amendments.
To Senate Bill 597.
Senate Bill 597.
Is there any discussion of the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 597? If not, the dash one amendments are approved.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Move the bill as amended to the floor to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Okay. Senate Bill 597 is moved to the Ways and Means Committee with the dash one amendments with no recommendation. Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Okay. Senate Bill 597 is moved to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Let's keep moving here. We got public hearing and possible work session. And I want to at least do the hearing part of these two bills together. It's House Bill 2138A and then House Bill 2606A. And it'll become clear why we're doing them together in a few minutes. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2138A defines the term recovery of anadromous salmonids for the purposes of the Oregon Plan. It defines terms that are used in the definition of recovery. It specifies that the governor or his designee have the power to negotiate with federal officials to recognize that the implementation of the Oregon Plan is used as a method to satisfy requirements of the Federal Endangered Species Act. This was introduced at the request of the Salmon Recovery Task Force during the interim. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact on the House measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Followed by House Bill 2606A, similarly defines the term recovery for the Salmon Trout Enhancement Program. Folks know that as the STEP program that's overseen by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and also defines terms similarly used in that definition. Specifically, it adds definitions for enhancement, listed unit, native fish stocks, naturally produced stocks, and populations. And it defines trout, recovery of trout, for purposes of the STEP program as well. We have no fiscal, no revenue impact on 2606A. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And okay, I'm going to let Representative Jensen come up first and testify. On both of these, we have some other people from all other organizations, but we'll start with the good representative. Bob, welcome. I'm glad you're here this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I see I've already scared off one of the members of the committee, so I brought just a little bit of testimony along with me this morning.
You're scared off more of us.
Mr. Chairman, I know that, and members of the committee, I know that their Department of Fish and Wildlife, I believe, is here to testify. But let me, if I may, give you a little bit of background on what fundamentally is both of these bills. In the 91 session, I sponsored a House Bill 3002, which created...
91 session?
91, not, I think the 2001, my apologies.
When, 2001.
I keep trying to move the calendar back, Senator.
We know you're old, but we don't think you've been around here that long, you know.
No, sir, my apologies. The 2001 session, we sponsored a House Bill 3002, which created a task force to define recovery for purposes of especially the Oregon plan. The reason for the creation of that task force was in response to the IMST, that's the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, that was created to be kind of one of the fundamental benchmarks, or not benchmark, but fundamental legs of the Oregon plan, to provide some scientific oversight and provide recommendations to the legislature and the governor in relationship to the Oregon plan and what needed to be done. And specifically, in one of their reports that they gave or sent to us, a technical report 2000-3, one of the recommendations, the first recommendation they had in that report was the IMST recommends that the state of Oregon define in measurable terms what is meant by the, quote, recovery, unquote, of depressed stocks of salmonid. That was the genesis then of House Bill 3002, creating the task force. The task force met then throughout the interim. We had a wide variety of membership in that task force, from representing the agencies, representing some of the industry, representing the environmental community, in fact, anyone who was wishing to either be in the task force or sit in on the task force would certainly have been welcome to do so. There were 9 major meetings of the task force and a number of subcommittee meetings. The task force was chaired by one Bob Jacobson, who worked very hard and very diligently to get there, to get to the point where we were able to bring forth a definition. In addition to the task force, House Bill 3002 from the 01 session, and I'll get right on the year on this time, also required that we conduct a scientific workshop to deal with that. We did conduct the scientific workshop. We had scientists from as far as the University of Montana, University of Idaho, Washington, and elsewhere. We had scientists from the National Marine Fisheries Services, as well as scientists in throughout our local area. The tribes were well represented also in the task force. At any rate, the outcome of that those efforts was the pre-session filing of House Bill 2138, which is a definition of recovery. This bill would have been before us, before you much earlier. We passed it out of the House very quickly, but brought it back to committee to make some, I think, substantial additions to it because of the interests, basically, of the federal agencies and the industry as they relate to those federal agencies, and the intent and purpose of those was to enable us to work more effectively and efficiently with the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, for the purposes of management of the endangered species in the Pacific Northwest, or in the state of Oregon. And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would be happy to go into the details of the bill for you, but I know that Ed Bowles is here, and I believe he's on your list to testify, and since that's the agency that is going to be principally involved, and I know your time is very short, I will not go into that testimony, but will be delighted to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions for Representative Jensen? I want to thank you for coming. I appreciate these efforts of, you know, really sitting down and defining, and I appreciate the work group approach. I think sometimes that can keep us out of trouble. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Senator Shields and Mr. Chairman. I suppose I might add one thing, and that is in relationship to House Bill 2606, which I believe you're hearing concurrently with this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As the committee administrator has indicated, that really is just an extension of 2138. At the time of the initial drafting, we were mindset on the anadromous species, and when we got through Governor's Office, Natural Resource staff, and at that time, Oregon Trout staff, earlier Oregon Trout staff, reminded me that we didn't have the STEP program included in this, the non-anadromous fish program included in this, and so we were forced to come up with a separate bill for that, and that's really the genesis of it. Fundamentally, the same principles are involved.
But both of them were kind of work grouped, is what...
That's true, Senator.
And that's what I'm after. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that. I'm going to ask Les Helgerson, who is first on my list, if he'll come up and share with us. Is he in the room? Yes, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Les Helgeson, for the record, representing Native Fish Society. I'd like to express our support for both bills today, and particularly like to compliment the Salmon Recovery Task Force and Jim Myron in particular for their hard work on House Bill 2138. And I'd like to thank Representative Jensen for working with myself and Tom Gilg of the Federation of Fly Fishermen on House Bill 2606. I think we've added a definition for enhancement. We've worked, sat down and discussed the bill with Ed Bowles, ODFW, and I think we've reached an acceptable agreement here. So with that, I'd urge you to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Both bills.
Both bills.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And now let's get Ed Bowles from ODF&W up here to talk for a little bit about these bills.
Chair Shields, committee members, my name is Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We are here today just with a simple message. We support both of these bills as amended through the House. I really appreciate the public process, Mr. Chair, that you brought up. That combined the legislative task force combined with a very public process that our agency went through with our native fish conservation policy really allowed these issues to be vetted through a real wide range of interest groups. A lot of hard work being done just to come up with some simple language. But as I found throughout my tenure here, the public and constituent groups really want to know what the bar is, and this allows the flexibility to custom tailor that bar as appropriate for different species and different watersheds and areas, but it does set the table for a clear definition of the bar for a particular area so people know what they're headed for and what to do when we get there. So I appreciate the work on both these bills the wide range of interests and support their passage.
You mentioned the broad range of people that were involved in the work group. Just for the record, could you rattle off some of the groups and constituents, stakeholders, if you please?
Sure. On the legislative task force, we had our department represented, as well as different other state agencies, Oregon Plan partner members, Ted Lorenzen from Oregon Department of Forestry, the Department of Agriculture, Division of Environmental Quality, Water Resources, and then beyond that, also had different constituents groups. Glenn Stonebrink from Cattlemen's Association attended the meetings there. We had some folks from GWEB and others, pretty good range represented in that. Had on our native fish conservation policy, which also dealt with these issues, had quite wide range all the way from Bill Bakke with Native Fish Society to Bill Mashofsky with Oregonians in Action, representing the Saver Salmon Coalition, and so a quite wide range of interest groups.
Are there environmental groups that you think of, or were there?
Yes, there were. There's Trout Unlimited participated in it through in our process with through Caitlin Lovell. We also had in our process groups from the Audubon Society and others, so we probably had half a dozen environmental groups.
Okay. My point in raising all that is that, in fact, this is a way to get through a problematic situation. Create a diverse, broad-based work group. Let them talk it out. So I appreciate you putting that in the record. Are there any other questions for Ed this morning? If not, I guess what I do is close the concurrent hearings on House Bill 2138 and 2606, and then we would open a hearing on, or a work session on 2138A.
Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 2138 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2138A to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Senator Corcoran? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. House Bill 2138A is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you carry the bill?
Sure.
And we'll close work session on 2138A and open a work session on House Bill 2606A.
Chair, I move House Bill 2606A to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer recommends House Bill 2606A be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye.
I'll make it up too.
Senator Beyer will carry, and House Bill 2606A is sent to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. So we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2606A, and we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2521A.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2521A creates a Southwest Oregon Landowner Preference Pilot Program to be implemented beginning July 1, 2004 and ending June 30, 2008. We have a no revenue impact, and the measure has a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sir, any testimony on this bill? I'm going to ask both Ron Anglin and Greg Addington to come up at the same time. Whoever is ready to go first has got the privilege of going first here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for ODFW. The bill that you have in front of you this morning has been a collaborative effort between the department and landowners within Southwest Oregon for the last several years, and basically better or refines our current landowner preference program to give us more flexibility in working with landowners to address damage on their property. And over the course of the next 4 years, our hope is to evaluate this and determine its applicability as a statewide effort, and express that we've had a lot of people come forward from that local level down there to assist us in developing this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Just a few... I'll be brief on my comments. In general, Farm Bureau is supportive of the Landowner Preference Tag Program. In 1997, a survey by the Oregon Ag Statistics Service showed that wildlife damage in this state cost farmers and ranchers over $158 million a year. And I would venture to guess that that figure has not gone down since that time. We view the Landowner Preference Tag Program as a tool that landowners can use to help manage that loss, and we appreciate the state's willingness to look at changes to improve the program. The current program gets mixed reviews from our members. Some feel it is too cumbersome and inefficient and doesn't go far enough. For the most part, however, we see the program as an important implement in managing a farm or ranch for economic output. This pilot program does not address all the changes we would like, but we think it's a move in the right direction, giving more flexibility to both the landowner who uses the tags and to the ODFW when issuing the tags. We support using Southwest Oregon as a place to test this program. The number of elk in the area continue to rise and pose a real problem to property owners in that area. In that area, you find many small farms. They suffer a tremendous amount of damage. This bill allows tags to be issued based on damage as opposed to a minimum acreage requirement. The language in the bill would also allow tags to be issued where landowners have historically received damage as opposed to the current reactive approach in which a landowner must first have the damage occur before a tag can be issued. Under current law, entire crops can be devastated before a tag is issued. The bill would also potentially benefit hunters by pushing game animals off private land and onto public land. There's several other things the bill does, but I would just summarize by saying that Farm Bureau supports the passage of House Bill 2521A. We're hopeful that ODFW will continue to move forward in addressing the issue of wildlife damage on private land. This bill is a good starting point, and we appreciate the cooperation of the department and the willingness of all the groups that have an interest in the state's wildlife to allow us to move forward and try some new things to deal with a growing problem.
Thank you. Just to be clear, you have said in here that the current program gets mixed reviews from your membership. Can you put a little flesh on that and how the bill improves that?
I think there's several issues, but... I think the flexibility that it gives landowners, and Ron may want to chime in too from a department standpoint, but it's been a cumbersome process. I think some landowners feel it's not worth the paperwork and keeping track of the tags and who did what and whatnot. I mean, there's other things that our folks would like to see, a more liberal program, perhaps allowing pursuit of animals off of private land onto public lands, where they'll typically be up on the public lands, come down onto private lands at night, eat, and then go back on the public lands, and they're not able to alleviate that problem. But this bill does not do that, but that's something we're willing to move forward with and continue to look at.
Any comments?
Senator Shields, the flexibility that Greg is talking about has been real key in this, because under our current system, we have to go out and do some verification of damage with the landowner, the fact that it's occurring there. They're limited as to the number of tags that we can offer them. They're limited as to the length of time that those tags can be used for. This bill opens that up, gives us a lot more flexibility to allow longer seasons, no minimum acreage requirements as stated earlier. So it really does provide some extra tools for us and give the landowner a better opportunity to deal with some of their problems in a lot quicker manner and not have us going out multiple times to try and help them deal with their problem.
Sounds good. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I would just point out that looking at the bill, I can see four distinct changes versus current law. That one, that it allows the you can use property owned, leased, or rented by landowners. Under current law, I believe that you have to own the land. It can't be rented or leased land. Also, there's no limit on the number of tags. There's no minimum acreage requirement. Current law, you have to have at least 40 acres before you're eligible for a landowner tag. And it allows the landowners to register at any time. Current law, you have to register prior to May 15th as a landowner. So those are improvements.
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate that. Yes, go ahead, Senator Corker.
I want to note it for the record that Greg Addington of the Farm Bureau used the word liberal in a non-pejorative fashion.
Well, we've got everything else on the record about this bill. I particularly appreciated what Senator Beyer put in the record. I guess we can allow that to go in the record, too.
Record's a record.
Okay.
Sometimes it's 45.
Are there any other questions of relevance this morning?
If you say 78, you're older than me.
If not, could I have, if I'm not interrupting these guys, could I have a motion of some sort?
Well, listen, we were here at 8. I don't know what time you got here, Mr. Chair.
I was here at 8, too. Oh, yes. Let's close the hearing. That would solve the problem and go to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2521 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2521 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Aye. Senator Corcoran, would you carry this bill?
I'd be honored. Very liberal farm worker bill. Yeah, right up my alley, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. Can we have a pilot program expanded to Portland?
With that, we're closing the hearing on 2521A.
I think there's a Cougar problem in Portland.
And we're opening a hearing on 2915, if we can.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2915 modifies membership and the method of appointment of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute Board of Directors. It allows persons paying the harvest tax on forest products to request a refund. It directs the Board of Directors to adopt rules relating to refunding monies from the Oregon Forest Resources Institute Fund and does declare an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got a few witnesses on this one. Let's start with Bart Starker and Ray Wilkerson from OFIC. Bart, I want to welcome you to the committee and thank you again for the tour of one of the best run forests I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
That's great.
That was an incredible day for me, too.
Good to have you here.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'll start out and be very brief and basically introduce Bart. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. This bill relates to the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, which is a quasi-state agency that was created by the legislature in 1991 for the purposes of providing education information to the people of Oregon about forestry. There have been, over the last couple years, a couple of constitutional issues raised about how the enabling legislation, how OFRI is currently structured. Those constitutional issues and problems are similar but not identical to those that have been identified relating to agricultural commodity commissions. Because they're not identical, this is a separate piece of legislation designed to do a similar purpose. OFIC represents private forest landowners who pay the harvest tax that funds OFRI's programs. That's their only source of funding, and I'm here basically to say that OFIC not only supports strongly OFRI and what it's doing and believe that those tax payments through the harvest tax are a good investment for us and for the state. We also strongly support this bill. It went through the House relatively without much opposition, 58-1, I think. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Bart. He's on the OFRI board. He's basically filling in today for the executive director who's out of state this week. So.
Okay. Bart?
Yeah. Chair Shields, member of the committee. I'm Bart Starker, member of the OFRI board. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2915, which addresses legal issues facing Oregon Forest Resources Institute. OFRI was established by the Oregon Legislature in 1991 to promote public understanding of Oregon's forest resources and forest practices, and to encourage sound forest management. We carry out this mission through a variety of forestry education programs, ranging from workshops and field trips for K-12 teachers and students to publications and training for forest landowners and Oregon citizens. I brought a few examples, and I think you've got one of them on your places there, but these are the kind of publications that OFRI prepares. This one in particular is one on Oregon's forest protection laws that's won the National Forestry Book of the Year. So it's been well regarded wherever it's been seen.
And I've actually spent a good bit of time reading that since you gave a copy to me. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a good book. So I hope you're familiar with some of those publications, and it sounds like most of you are. While OFRI and Oregon Agricultural Commodity Commission share similarities, our purposes are very different. OFRI's mission is forestry education rather than product marketing. Our implementing legislation specifically directs us to serve as a source of accurate forestry information in collaboration with Oregon State University College of Forestry and the Oregon Department of Forestry. We are funded exclusively by a harvest tax on forest products producers and governed largely by a board representing those producers who are elected by their peers. The board consists of a small, medium, and large forest products producers, a small woodlands owner representative of forestry employees as voting members, the dean of the College of Forestry, and a public representative appointed jointly by the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House serve as ex officio members. The board election is conducted by the state forester, and who also certifies our budget. OFRI board has authority to set the harvest tax rate up to a ceiling established by OFRI's implementing legislation. OFRI has functioned extremely well under the structure. We have enjoyed the support of constituents, developed strong partnerships with the Department of Forestry and the College of Forestry, and have earned the reputation as a credible provider of forestry education programs with schools, journalists, community leaders, forest landowners, and general public statewide. OFRI helps the forest sector connect positively with private, public, urban, and rural leaders concerned both with economic recovery and maintaining Oregon's strong environmental performance. This is a unique, productive public-private sector partnership, and we frequently receive calls from forestry interests in other states wanting to emulate what Oregon has created. So if OFRI isn't broke, why fix it? The OFRI board wished no changes were necessary. However, the Oregon Department of Justice has advised OFRI that a few modifications to our governing structure are needed to address both federal and state constitutional issues. The recent federal court decisions have placed in question the ability of commissions and organizations like OFRI to use mandatory assessments for product promotion and other purposes. The concern is that mandatory assessments have been construed by some courts as compelled speech, resulting in violation of First Amendment freedom of speech protection. The Department of Justice also has identified potential concerns related to delegation of governing authority under Oregon Constitution. A more thorough description of these legal issues, I think, was presented to this committee by Attorney General Hardy Myers on March 31st. Department of Justice has recommended changes OFRI needs to make to ensure that we are less vulnerable to legal challenge on these issues. Because government bodies are protected against freedom of speech charges, the recommended solution is to tie OFRI more closely than it already is to state government by asking the state forester to appoint the OFRI board members rather than conduct election for them. Board composition and board member qualifications would be clarified to remain intact. The provision authorizing OFRI's constituents to petition for dissolution would be removed, meaning the legislative action would be required to dissolve OFRI. These recommendations are included in House Bill 2915. House Bill 2915 also provides for a tax rebate for producers who claim their freedom of speech has been violated. This was added both to assuage constituent concerns about potential loss of control of OFRI programs and because it significantly strengthens OFRI's legal position on a freedom of speech issue. According to the Department of Justice, no action is not an option. 2915 addresses the legal issues raised with a minimum amount of change to OFRI's highly functional structure. The three modifications made by House Bill 2915 are: the board will be appointed, not elected; the dissolution by petition process will be removed; and harvest taxpayers will be afforded the opportunity to apply for a refund. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I respectfully urge you to pass this bill out of committee.
Are there any questions? I appreciate your testimony, Bart. Refundability, interesting concept. Just a little humor for somebody that might be inclined to listen in. Okay, I guess the Farm Bureau folks are not. Any questions? If not, let's close the hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On House Bill 2915 and go to a work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 2915 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2915 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I don't know that I need to, but I'll declare a conflict of interest since how I pay taxes into the OFRI program.
Okie dokie. Senator Beyer declares conflict.
Don't consider them taxes, Senator. It's a contribution. It's a liberal tax.
And under refundability, I guess you can get it back, can't you?
I don't know. I have to see, I guess, if I want to.
Well, it seems that this bill is very clear. Wait a minute. I did a bad thing. I forgot to talk and listen. Let Ted Lawrenson and other people.
That's not a bad thing, Mr. Chair. That is not a bad thing.
I've got a sign here that says you want to talk, you want the bill.
Well, let's see. Do you want us to continue just to pass this bill, or do you guys want to talk? There's Ted Lawrenson, Jerry, and then there's Christina McNutt. I'm sorry, I forgot. I missed it. Do you want us to stop?
Put your hands down, please.
Put my hands down. Okay, we are at the point where we've made the motion. We've been discussing this. We can call the roll while Senator Corcoran's out of the room.
Senator Corcoran? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Yes, we did do a motion on this, and that motion has just passed. And that will close the work session on House Bill 2915. I'd love to carry this one myself. Can I carry this one? This one looks like a fun one to carry. If we can keep Corcoran from getting carried away. Now it looks like my agenda's disappeared. That's what it looks like. Okay. 3175 is next on the agenda. Here, I found my agenda again. Gee, every time we have a work session, people get up and leave. We should quit doing that. 3175A.
Did you open the public hearing?
I'm opening a public hearing on 3175A, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. House Bill 3175A directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish by rule criteria and procedures for green permits. makes the acceptance, processing, and issuing of green permits discretionary for the commission. It requires the Department of Environmental Quality to recover full direct, indirect, and associated costs. And it requires an initial deposit for green permit proposals in an amount not to exceed $25,000. The measure declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement on the measure, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. We have two folks that want to speak, and I'm going to get them both up here at the same time so I don't forget somebody. Mr. Ledger, come on up. And Lori Annan from DEQ. Annan. My apologies. Since he can't write it clearly, I'm not going to use Mr. Ledger's first name. I can't. Can you read that?
I see who's sitting there.
Yeah, I see who, but we'd never know it looking at this, would you?
Jomo?
He's illiterate. His parents weren't married.
Are you ready?
I am. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. This bill deals with the Green Permits Program.
He has to put his name in for the record.
John Ledger.
Oh, this is John. It's John.
With AOI. I have ID with me. But this deals with the Green Permits Program. The Green Permits Program is a voluntary agreement between the DEQ and a company, and both sides have to agree to do it. And there have been maybe seven or eight issued since it was established. And the idea is that if a company is doing something exceptionally good, then they get rewarded, and it might be a reduction in the amount of reporting they have to do. A lot of times companies would just like to, in fact, just to get kind of the stamp of a green permit. I mean, that's of some value to them also. This bill doesn't make a lot of changes in the existing program. The existing program is due to sunset at the end of this year, and this pushes it out until the end of 2008. There was talk about it being discretionary by the department, and I believe it always was. This clarifies it. Also, it allows the department to take up to $25,000 sort of as a deposit against doing the permit. The permit's entirely funded by the company. It's entirely voluntary, and this just allows them to take some more money to work on the permit. It just clarifies that all the costs are borne by the person applying for the permit, be direct or indirect, so that would cover things like public hearings also. This is a good program. It's a national model, and we'd like to see it extended. I'm not aware of any opposition to it anywhere.
Lori?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lori Onan with the Department of Environmental Quality. I really don't have anything to add to what Mr. Ledger had to say. I wanted to just put on the record that we worked with him on the amendments, and we support the amendments, and thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
I have a question for both of you. It just comes out of my history with the bill, and that is that in 97, I believe it was, when we did this bill, the chair of the Energy Committee in the House was Leslie Lewis, and she asked me to join her, and the two of us did this work group, and that was kind of initially a tense meeting. She said, I'll get the business community there, you get the environmental community there, and anybody doesn't want to show up, tell them that we're going to have a bill anyway, with or without their presence. It was kind of an effective methodology in getting attendance. And so, beginning from that, why has this kind of evolved into something that's totally non-controversial and that nobody has any concerns about and so on? What have we done right? Tell me.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think what that reflects is there's a terrific amount of distrust on all sides about many things. And I think there was concern on some parties that the Green Permits Program could be used as kind of almost like a scam or to get around rules and regulations. And there's concerns on the industry part that perhaps it would be too burdensome and really doesn't get us where we want to go. So I think that was just part of the normal adversarial process.
So, Lori, you're the perfect one to follow what John has just said, and that is there hasn't been any scamming or anything like that they were worried about.
Mr. Chair, no. What followed the adoption of the statute was DEQ then had to do a rulemaking to kind of define the program, and we had a broad-based advisory committee that, in fact, has continued until recently to implement the program and kind of evaluate it and look at it. So we had good participation on that, and I think when that happens, when people sit down together and see how things are really working, you can sometimes get over that distrust. So,
will there be a chance that this would expand now that you've extended to Sunset? I mean, I don't understand why it's such a small program that more people don't take advantage of.
Mr. Chairman, getting one of these is very laborious. I mean, it's a lot of time. It's a lot of effort. There's some expense involved. And the DEQ, or I think EPA, just did a fairly extensive study of the program. And I don't recall the recommendations, but it's been looked at fairly heavily. I mean, we'd like to see it streamlined. I expect it will be. I think DEQ wants to see it streamlined, too. But it's a brand new thing. Oregon was a pioneer on this, really. And it takes a little while to catch on, see what works, what doesn't work. It's experimental.
When you say EPA's taking a look at it, is that because they'd like to see it other places in the country?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's true.
Okay. Lori, comment?
Mr. Chair, yes, actually Oregon has been a national model for this type of approach, and it is, when it passed in 97, and then it took a while to get the program in place, it is new. When we took a look at it through our advisory committee, they recommended some changes, which in fact I think, as Mr. Ledger says, we'd like to do. Just to put on the record also, we've had, given the budget situation for the state, one of the things that did happen this year was we lost our Green Permits Program coordinator who was doing the advisory committee. And so I think the program's going to continue. We obviously need to look at resources and where we put our priorities. But I guess what I'd say is the extension of the sunset gives us a chance to say this program's in place. We actually like what it can accomplish. And to expand it probably takes more looking at, okay, what do we really need to do and how do we implement things. But again, that just gives us time to keep it in place, and hopefully resources will come that allow us to do that.
And John made reference to streamlining. Is there potential for that?
Mr. Chair,
the parameters of safety
that,
and
so Mr. Chair, that would take a rulemaking. And again, as I said, we lost our coordinator for the program. Right now, the way this has to work is if a company wants a green permit, they have to go to our regional permit writers. And so there's nobody whose job it would be, for example, to do a rulemaking. So I think it's definitely been identified. And if we can get through the next couple of years and hopefully things improve, maybe we can take a look at doing that again.
Are there other questions?
Leslie Lewis and Frank Shields. That's just an odd picture.
I think we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3175A. And we're going to open a work session on 3175A.
Chair, I move House Bill 3175A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 3175A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
He's an aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. I want to carry this one, if that's okay with everybody. Gee. We will close a work session then on 3175A and open a work session on House Bill 2945A, or public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. House Bill 2945A allows the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to impose conditions on surface mining operating permits necessary to mitigate offsite effects to groundwater resources caused by the removal of water from a surface mine. It exempts removal of water from a surface mine from the requirement to obtain a water right permit or water right certificate unless water is later used for beneficial use. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Looks like we've got several folks testifying on the bill. I'll start with Rich Ankrum and just ask Judith if she makes sure that I don't forget to
get them all up there.
Do you want to get them all up there at once? Gary Lynch needs to leave. Okay, let's get Gary Lynch up too. And who's this?
Adam Sussman.
Adam, come on up. We'll just get you all here at once. That way, Do you guys want to flip a coin? Gary, do you have to rush away? Do you want to go first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. We worked with the industry and Water Resources Department in the last interim. We believe this is a good bill. It strengthens our enforcement capability and at the same time streamlines the permit process. And with that, I will conclude my comments unless there are any questions.
Okay. Rich, would you like to hold forth for a second?
Yeah, good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. Once again, I would concur with Mr. Lynch's comments. This is a streamlining bill. It clarifies jurisdiction and enhances the department's ability to mitigate for off-site impacts when we're conducting what's called a dewatering activity. That's all I have to say.
Okay, great.
Good morning. For the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department. And as both of these gentlemen have said, there's some overlapping jurisdiction between Dogami and the Water Resources Department. And what this bill really does is really clarify the roles of the respective agencies. And so in that respect, it really is a streamlining bill. And of equal importance, there's been some uncertainty about whether or not a water right permit is required for dewatering a surface mine, and this puts to rest any uncertainty about that and clarifies the process for all of those involved. And the department does support this bill.
Great. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you for your time this morning. We'll close the hearing on 2945A and open a work session on 2945A.
Chair, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2945A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran? Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Senate Bill 2945A passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to ask Senator Beyer. Senator Fisher, would you like to carry this bill?
It's fine.
Okie dokie. Thank you very much. And with that, let's open a hearing on House Bill 2887A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2887A adds the definition of point and non-point source pollution to Oregon statutes. The definitions are identical to the definitions under the Federal Clean Water Act. And this would duplicate those definitions in DEQ's water quality statutes. We have received a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Katie Fast and Karen Turner. How do you pronounce that?
That's right, Turner.
Okay. My apologies. I'm not all that good at reading this stuff. Katie, would you like to go first?
I certainly will. Good morning, Senator Shields, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The Oregon Cattlemen's Association requests the passage of House Bill 2887, which defines point source and non-point source pollution as used in the laws relating to water pollution. This bill passed the House unanimously on the consent calendar. As Judith explained, the point source pollution definition mirrors the language of the Federal Clean Water Act, which the Department of Environmental Quality implements for the state of Oregon. The definition of non-point pollution is defined in the bill to mean any source of pollution other than a point source. This is a clarification that is needed to distinguish the difference between non-point and point source pollutions. There are two areas of 468B where non-point and point source pollution is used. The first is relating to TMDLs, or total daily max or total maximum daily loads, and the second is in areas of groundwater concern. Our membership's concern is mainly with the TMDL establishment. When waste load allocations are established, there is possible regulation in the agricultural community, the non-point source polluters, to meet the standards. And our membership is concerned that we need to have in the Oregon statute the clarification between non-point and point source pollution. This bill does mirror the federal, and it's only asking clarification between the two definitions. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Wilkinson with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The Oregon Farm Bureau has not been involved in the discussions and drafting of this bill. The Oregon Cattlemen's Association has, but we do want to come up here and lend our support to the bill. The agriculture industry is experiencing a revolution when it comes to water quality related regulations. We're experiencing more regulations. So farmers and ranchers across the state are becoming more and more familiar with the EQ statutes and the statutes for Oregon Department of Agriculture. And the terms point source and non-point source are very crucial to understanding those water quality regulations because they determine what types of regulations you fall under. It will be easier to have in our own state statutes those definitions that mirror the federal ones so that we don't have to refer to the federal statutes, which just results in more confusion. So this is a clarification, mirroring the federal statutes, bring it into our state statutes to make our water quality program more whole. That's how the Farm Bureau sees this, this bill, providing a good service to our existing programs. For these reasons, we support House Bill 2887. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Karen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Karen Tarna with the Water Quality Division at the Department of Environmental Quality. Our agency is neutral on the bill. Obviously, we've been implementing the Clean Water Act provisions without it in our state statutes. We see no particular advantages or disadvantages to it, although I can concur with what Jean was saying about having it more easy to find in our statutes should we need to discuss matters relating to point or non-point source could assist in that conversation. We don't anticipate it having any effect on the way we do our work, and as so we're neutral on the bill, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do that.
So what you're saying is that the you've been able to do your job without it, but this does not complicate your job.
No, sir.
Okay. And it really won't change the way you do what you've been doing. It brings it into kind of a conformity with the federal statute on the one hand, and it makes it easier for people to find it with its definitions in the Oregon statute.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, if you've ever tried to dig up the Clean Water Act, it's a challenging thing to do sometimes. So, yeah, having it in our statutes may make it easier for yourselves and public to make reference to it.
Okay. And you said it came through the House unanimously? Okay. Any other questions? Sounds good. I'm going to close the hearing on 2887 and open a work session on House Bill 2887.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2887 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves 2887 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I'll just point out you're now. You cut off two witnesses on the bill before. You got an extra one here. You didn't call up, so you're only one down now.
Oh, thank you. Money minus one. Anybody want to count?
Yeah.
If
here's Dave Nelson, the guy that can never get an airplane ticket. Why don't you pull him in and testify? and the point is?
Am I opening a work session?
Yes.
I think I'm supposed to be opening a work session on 2887. He already made a motion.
I'll make the motion again.
Make the motion again. See what you did to me?
Move 2887.
This is quite the committee.
Yeah, and that's what we did. We moved 2887 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think before all this started, I asked for discussion. Discussion? There is no discussion. Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No kidding.
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. And 2887 is moved to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Since this is the first bill in about six that Senator Corcoran has shown up to vote on.
I was here at 8 o'clock, Mr. Chair, unlike you. Showed up at 8:22. You think you're Tom Bryan or something, Revenue Committee. But I'm happy to be here. Yes, I'd love to carry that bill.
Okay.
That's fine.
We are aware.
Non-force source pollutants.
Representative Krupp is here, so let's do 2344A. We don't want to show it's off right. for him any more than we have to.
Because I wasn't there.
Just
that on the
I warn you that Senator Corcoran is in the room, so you enter at your own risk.
Yankee's here. This is my favorite representative, and he's not even in leather. I am so jacked. Wow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and esteemed members of the committee, including my friend and sometimes verbal opponent, Senator Smokey, and don't ask me to explain that. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17, and 2344 is a bill that Representative Bob Jensen and I pinned together after touring the Bridge Creek Fire, which happened in August of 2001 over near Ukiah, Oregon. And what we found is this was ODF&W land that had been purchased with federal dollars. There was some parks land next to it. And ODF&W simply doesn't manage a lot of lands that have forest land on it. They did not have a policy or plan in place. They didn't simply know how you go about restoring a burnt forest afterwards. And what's occurred is a fair amount of delay, and we've lost a lot of timber that's on the ground that is and I saw this with my own eyes, the fungus, the blue fungus, is eating its way through the wood. There'll be no recoverable timber there. They still have not begun the recovery process. And in addition to that, it was obvious to us there was some additional federal land next to it and some state parks land next to it. State parks have dealt with this before. They were able to come in and do, for other reasons, some limited recovery and restoration. The federal lands, nothing has been done on that. And what we saw, what was very disturbing, was in the federal lands, the fire burned very hot. And on some very steep slopes, the ground was just baked, for lack of a better term. It was so hot that the ground was very unstable. And we saw some of that on the state land, but in all honesty, most of that was over on the federal side. But the problem is these are very steep slopes. Water hits them wintertime, and the soils erode dramatically. And we need, in my opinion, after having observed this, we need a policy set forth that all state agencies that have oversight of state forest lands would make certain that they have a policy in place to begin recovery and restoration. And I use both of those terms because they go hand in hand in the process here. At the earliest possible moment, and that they have the plan in place. The reason that ODF&W was unable to achieve this, frankly, is because they had never done it before. They just didn't know the steps you go through to make this happen. And that's the problem that we're trying to rectify here, Mr. Chairman. This bill, 2344, it just directs each state agency to adopt and implement policies and plans to deal with this. If you read the language of the bill, and I have to really thank the Department of Forestry, which has a long-standing policy to do with this. Okay, so at any rate, you can read the language of the bill. We talk about social, economic, environmental values. And we talk about, frankly, coordinating through DAS and contracting policies. That's an important procedure because they're the people that that do all of that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the indulgence of your committee's time and would say that your committee runs much the way mine does.
Mr. Chair, how possibly
would
you don't
dare
have
to deserve
Senator
that
Corcoran.
Insult?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator Fisher.
Would ask the good representative, he's trying to confound Rudyard Kipling here. I thought that this was in northeastern Oregon, not northwestern Oregon, as your testimony said. I didn't know that. I thought east was east and west was west, and never the twain shall meet.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fisher, I thank you for pointing out an obvious faux pas on my part for drafting error, shall we say. Faux pas is a screw-up, Senator Corker. I noticed you looking at me there with some
screw-up is being kind. Dear.
Dear. Is there any relevant discussion on this bill?
I would ask you, Mr. Chairman, then, if the committee would be so kind as to send this bill to the floor for a vote. Thank you.
Any discussion? Other discussion? Relevant discussion? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to ask Bill Cluding. Is that right? Bill, come up. Come on up, Bill. Sorry, I'm having trouble reading people's writing this morning.
Right, poorly, sir.
My apologies for. How you doing, sir?
Morning, Chair Shields. Committee, for the record, my name is Bill Cluding. I represent the Western Council of Industrial Workers here in the state of Oregon. I represent 4,000 workers. Still got 4,000. I lost another mill here just a month ago. Our workers, we work in the forest. We work in the mills, timber-related wood mills in this state. Our livelihood depends on a timber supply. Forest health is a driving factor for a stable supply of timber for our mills, saving our jobs. Any delay of restoration of a diseased or burnt forest has to be eliminated. With Oregon's poor economic conditions today, utilizing the funds from timber sales for our state, county, and school budgets are needed now and in the future. With the committee's permission, I am here today to endorse both House Bill 2344 and House Bill 3552 to save your time. Thank you, and I'll try and answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Bill. With that, I'll close the hearing on 2344 and open a work session on House Bill 2344. Is there any discussion of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2344A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2344 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
I think he said aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Biden?
Aye.
Chair
Shield? Aye. I'm sorry. We're going to close that hearing on 2344A. Senator.
You mean the work session?
I'm asking Senator Fisher if you would carry 2344A on the floor of the Senate.
I'll do that.
And we'll open a hearing on 3152A.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3152A requires the Department of Administrative Services to coordinate with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Parks and Recreation Department, State Forestry Department, Division of State Lands, and other agencies with state forest land oversight responsibilities to adopt forest management plans or policies. It authorizes DAS to develop forest fuel reduction and forest health restoration projects. We have received a no revenue, no fiscal impact statement on measure.
Okay. Bill just said he's already given his testimony on this one. He's the only person signed up. Is there anybody else that wants to testify? Yeah. If not, we'll just close the hearing on 3152A and open a working session on 3152A.
Chair, I move House Bill 3152A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves 3152 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shield?
Aye. Who wants to carry them? Do you want to take
it? Sure.
I've already set a record. I'm carrying two in one day. So we're closing our work session on 3152A, and we're opening our work session on 3376. A public hearing. We're opening a public hearing on 3376A.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3376A comes at the request of the Oregon Grocery Association. It directs the Public Utility Commission to set a date on which electric companies must announce prices that will be charged for electricity in subsequent calendar year. It provides that retail electricity customers who are eligible for direct access must be allowed at least 3 business days after the date set by the Commission to elect whether to use direct access or to purchase electricity from an electric company. It requires all electricity service suppliers and companies to announce estimated prices that they will charge for electricity in the subsequent year or contract period at least 5 days before the date set by the Commission. It does declare an emergency effective on passage. There is a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We've got Joe Gillum, who would like to speak on the bill, and the infamous Lee Beyer, if he would like to come up at the same time. Joe, welcome. Glad to hear this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Joe Gilliam with the Oregon Grocery Association. We brought this bill to the legislature for a simple reason. As we've started to experience open access to electricity and picking electricity providers, for grocery stores, it's a huge cost, monthly cost for a grocery store because of refrigeration and the lights and such in the store. And as we go into this and trying to find our best price and keep our costs down, it's a difficult process in terms of the complexity of the market. And what we experienced last year as we went into a chance to pick our provider, and basically in the PGE market, you could either decide to stay with PGE or go to a competing electric company that would provide your power. And PGE set a date of a 3-day business days starting at 5 p.m. on Friday, and you had to make your choice by 5 p.m. on Monday. So they put the period of time you had to choose whether to stay in or out over a weekend. What sub 1 of section 2 does is says that there's a minimum 3-day period for choosing your electric provider, but it has to be business days. So you get 3 business days to make a choice. And that's very important to a grocery store, particularly an independent store, who doesn't have a staff of people who are working the electric market every day. They're trying to pick and make a decision that's going to be a difference between maybe $19,000 a month and $16,000 a month in electricity. It's a big bill for them. It's one of the biggest as far as utilities and costs in a grocery store. The sub 2 says that as you approach that date where the 3 days starts, the electric companies, anybody who's going to offer electricity as a service, gives you a ballpark figure 5 days out. Now, that doesn't bind them to it, doesn't bind anybody to the contract, but it gives the grocery store owner or any retail owner out there an idea of where the market's going as they're coming in, more of a glide path, if you will, coming into landing. And so you have a basic number, and then you have, after that, 3 days to decide. So it's really kind of an 8-day process and would really benefit the retail community out there as they try to make a decision as a consumer.
Thank you.
My turn?
I was wanting to say Senator Byers, but Senator Byers.
You already got one of those.
Got one of those. Although he's getting tired of getting fired all the time in a newspaper. I understand.
I've been fired from the Pocket for a few times.
You've been, he's been fired from the PUC.
My apologies, Senator Byer. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Lee Beyer, Commissioner with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about what's beginning to be my least favorite subject. one of the original supporters of Senate Bill 1149, I've discovered it's a whole lot more complex to try and make it work than I thought that it would be when I was in the legislature. But the commission is committed to try and making 1149 work and providing the direct access for customers. And it hasn't been easy. We've gone through 2 rounds of openings now, and these only go back a year. In fact, a little less than a year, actually. And it's we find it's a little more complex. The issue that really is out there that I'm not going to bore you with all the details is how do you make the requirement in the law that the legislature put in terms of making sure that there's no cost transfers between those people who choose to stay with the utility and those people who choose to seek and leave someplace else for all transition charges. And that's difficult, and it has been, on how long to keep the market open. What we've done, and Joe is absolutely right with the timing and what happened last time, there actually was a little longer time in PG for very large customers who wanted to leave the market for a five-year period. It was a voluntary thing because it's something that PG put in the works to offer them. We put a study group in place and went out and talked to all the industry, and we've got a group working in it now. We actually think that the window needs to be somewhere between 2 weeks and a month, actually, for that posting of price. So the 3 days notice really probably doesn't make any difference. That's too small, we think. The one that is more problematic potentially is the posting of the estimated, or the bill calls them an indicative price. The issue there is really in terms of, are you going to get competitors into the marketplace? I was talking with Fred Venata just this morning before the meeting. He represents one of the most active potential suppliers in the state, and they'd kind of wrangled through it and finally decided it didn't make any difference. And the reason to them, because the price that they post doesn't have any bearing on the price they actually offer a customer in the end. The way the competitive market will work is you have the incumbent utility providing a price. They actually provide two things. A customer with PGE and PacifiCorp has three options. They can say, I'm just going to stay in the regulated market where I know what the price is going to be. Or they can say, I'm going to step out of that. I'm going to stay with the utility, but I'm going to go with them and ask them to play the market for me, either on a daily basis, a monthly basis, a quarterly or an annual basis, so their predictability there. Or they can choose to go to a completely separate provider. The issue with going to the separate provider is what they have is they can strike a deal. PGE Pacific can't negotiate their rates. That's the nature of cost-regulated industry. An individual outside of that can negotiate that price, and that's what makes it a competitive marketplace, and that's why they're unlikely to want to set a special price in the market. So that's an issue. By setting that, will we actually be driving potential competitive suppliers out of the state? Don't know the answer to that. We've had concern expressed to us. We've had one, as I told you, that has said, well, they think it wouldn't make a difference to them. The other issue is really, it's interesting to put it in statute saying you have to post an indicative price. We don't have a mechanism for anybody to post an indicative price in this state.
Yeah.
That's twice the commissioner has used that word and said it's in the bill. I can't find it anywhere. Indicative?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, indicative price.
Indicative.
It's the ballpark. It's an estimated
price.
Yeah, it's the term used in the power community. It's not in the bill, but it's not necessarily
term used by the power community.
Community to say an indicative price is I'm going to indicate to you what my price may be in so many days or so many weeks or next year.
No.
I mean, it's not a necessarily a term of art, more of a insider. If you will, I mean,
yeah,
you know,
I apologize for using
the
terminology.
What it means,
did we take it out of the bill?
Mr. Chair, it just says at least 5 days before the date set by the commission.
Okay,
but we didn't call it an indicative price, Mr. Chair. We didn't want to bind anybody to say that you have to give a price that has to be available in 5 days, because after testimony from the PUC and others saying that that's going to be too tight and you're going to scare people away, we can't do that. All we're asking for is consumers are saying, give us a ballpark coming into it so we can start making the decision as the date comes forward. The 3 days, too, is just a minimum. If the PUC says we're going to make it a month out or 2 weeks out, they can still do it under the bill, and we think that's great. The more time, the better. We just want to have that minimum 3 business days. You can't do the weekend thing again.
Commissioner Beyer. It would seem to me that posting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday would buy the utility a whole lot of negative kind of feelings What's the rationale? I mean, they must have weighed this. They're intelligent business people. Why would they do this?
Their issue when they did it is the in posting the price, you have to guess what the market's going to be. Figure that out to the transition cost. And the longer you, I mean, this is their rationale, the longer you leave that window open, the more likely it is that you're going to transfer some of those costs onto other customers. Now, obviously, we've disagreed with them, some at the commission already, and that, so that's a reasonable concern. However, the legislature set a process for competitiveness, and we need to make that work. Our biggest problem at the commission with the bill is it's very hard to make this all work, and the more of it you put in statute, the more difficult it is for us to adjust it to meet the market. We're trying to work with the market participants to make it work, and it's not easy. And to the extent you put it in statute, that means that we are precluded from making an adjustment that may be necessary for 2 years. That's the issue. Although I'm not.
Is that a serious danger that could cause you unintended trouble?
Frankly, Mr. Chair, the 3 days is not a big problem. Okay. Anymore. It's not. It's just the. It's Joe and I were talking. He says you should just say it's the annoyance factor. And I think that's probably true. It's down to when we start putting more of this in statute, you lose the flexibility to adjust it. I can tell you that all states that are trying to deal with this, most of them are trying to do it through rule because the market changes and you need the ability to adapt to make it work to it. That's the issue. But
hopefully,
this is not a major item.
Hopefully not to embarrass the commission, but why didn't you already have this in rule then? If most states are doing this.
This in rule? We've had processes evolving and try to do it. We've gotten to that. It's just we're trying to adapt that system to make it work. I understand this is a system that's been designed by the industry, and as Senator Corkman knows, he's not a great fan of the open marketplace. It's difficult to make work. Oregon, you should understand in direct access, Oregon is doing it completely differently than all the other states in the union. The big factor is how do you deal with transition costs? We have decided as a state, the legislature has decided that we're going to try to do it without allowing any of the people who choose to stay to be harmed by those who choose to leave. Other states have not made that decision. They've said you get a one-time choice, you leave and you're gone for sure, for permanent, and you can't get back under cost regulation. The legislature said we don't want to do that. We don't want to allow anybody to come back. That means you have a moving target on your transition costs. The other thing that other states have done that have started this is they have at a one time, they have bought out all of the transition costs, the fixed costs that utilities have had either through spreading them across all the ratepayers and going to a bidded cost on an annual basis, or they've chosen, as California did, to float bonds to pay the utilities back to open the market up. We chose not to do that. We chose to use a moving target. And when you do that, it's somewhat more difficult to protect the customers that choose not to go by the few that choose to go. And, you know, it's just trying to get that balance in. It's not an easy thing to do. It's a lot more difficult than I thought it was as a legislator. There is some question I'm beginning to feel, I can't speak for the other commissioners, that there's some question about whether you can actually do it without transferring some of those costs. But we're still going to try. We're working on it. And we do have a group, as Mr. Gillum said, doing that right now. And we will have another open window this fall. And we hope to give people a broader range. And frankly, the other thing is that people who have an interest in this, which is predominantly the large users, are learning more about the system, and there's more stability. Now, keep in mind the other thing in terms of the market that we've been working in right now is the fact that the market went crazy. We have never seen the market gyrate the way it did in 2000, 2001, and it's starting to do again a little bit because of natural gas. There are just multiple things out there. It's very hard to deal with that from a business perspective. You really got to make a decision whether you want to invest the time to try and guess what the market's going to do or whether you want to stay with the stability of a regulated price. That's just the way the market's working right now.
Mr. Chair, many of the things that the commissioners talked about is things we took in consideration. We took out of the bill on the House side. We had a lot of transition costs. We had other things built in, so you wouldn't get stung with that. And he made a convincing argument that you don't want that piece there.
Don't want to go there.
Yeah, and so we took that out and basically tried to stay clear of all those pricing issues, just to the point we got to have enough time to make a decent decision on a big bill for us. And that's really what we strive to get down to just the annoyance factor.
Okay. Well, you've got me satisfied. Are there other questions? If not, let's close the hearing on House Bill 3376, A engrossed, and open a work session on House Bill 3376, A engrossed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3376, A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 3376, A to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. And 3376A is moved to the floor of the Senate. I'm going to ask the other Beyer, Senator Beyer, if he'll carry the bill. And that concludes our workload this morning. And with that, we'll adjourn the committee.